Welcome to Vital Voices. Our guest today is a well-known maker of Windsor chairs. Curtis Buchanan of Jonesboro, Tennessee, has over 40 years of experience as a Windsor chair maker. His chairs are in use at Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, in Virginia, and around the breakfast table at the Tennessee Governor's Mansion in Nashville. Two of his chairs are in the permanent collection at the Tennessee State Museum. Curtis Buchanan, welcome to Vital Voices.
Thanks for having me, Fred. Glad to be here.
Let's start out by defining what a Windsor chair is and where that term originally came from.
Well, Windsor is a stick chair. It has a plank seat, and all the parts stop at the seat. So that's the simplest explanation you could have of one. So in other words, the back leg does not continue on up past the seat to form the back itself, like you might see in some other chairs.
And why is it called Windsor?
Probably the term, I guess when they were first made, they went under all kinds of different names. But eventually Windsor stuck from the chairs that were made possibly around Windsor Castle in the early 1700s. They were predated actually probably by Welsh stick chairs of maybe even a century earlier, certainly 50 years before. I don't think the Welsh stick chairs been given the credit that it really deserves for being the precursor to what we think of as a Windsor chair now. But at any rate, it was the early 1700s and then probably 1720s. Of course, anything that became popular in England only took a week or so for it to get over here. And the Americans took it. So there's English Windsor chairs and then American Windsor chairs. And they're quite different. And the American chairs made out of different woods. We had more choices than the English did. And we put our own spin on it. We made it more rakish, more voluptuous. And most people prefer the style that the Americans came up with, even though a lot of them were basically the English chair. The earlier ones probably started appearing, quite early, like I said, even in the 1720s or 30s, and maybe around Philadelphia, where the big shipping port and all that. But quickly spread. But by the time of the Revolution, one in two pieces of furniture made in the colonies just before the Revolution was a Windsor chair. They were extremely popular, and they were made the idea that these chairs were made in small little one-man shops is really not correct. That's what we do nowadays. But at that time, there were what's called manufactories, and they were in large city centers. Lots of people working. They maybe turning shops, supplying parts for it by order, apprentices making certain parts, master chair maker putting it together, which is the hardest part of the chair, putting it together. You can go back in old newspapers. I have never researched these old newspapers. I just see copies in books and such, and showing where there might be 1,200 chairs on hand that people could buy right then, sell them for, say, $2 a piece or so. A lot of them were shipped down to the islands. They were used as outdoor furniture. They were painted with lead paint, so they weathered pretty well. Bottoms of the chairs rotted. The legs were typically maple, which rots quick, but also then it was stuck down into the ground. But even in the colonies, the chairs were used as outdoor furniture, porch furniture, kitchen furniture, and they were cheap enough to where maybe the general public could own one or so. I think they were viewed as being expendable, maybe like today's outdoor furniture that we buy and throw it away when it isn't looking so good.
What was it about the Windsor chair that appealed to people? Was it aesthetics? Was it comfort? Was it a combination of the two?
Yeah, combination of the two, exactly. They're extremely comfortable if made correct. That, once again, we get to the difference between the American chair and the English chair. The English used elm for their seats. Very hard, durable, but not carved, not typically carved as deep, as the American Windsor. The Americans used Eastern White Pine, other softwoods too, but Eastern White was probably the one that was most used. And so you didn't need strength there in the seat because you had bulk. The pine seat was almost 2 inches thick, and so you had strength through the bulk. But since it was soft, you could carve it really deep for comfort pretty fast, and it didn't add extra weight to the chair. And a light chair was desirable, still is desirable. It's still the only piece of furniture that you move around the house.
You can pick it up with one hand, yeah. A lot of these.
Yeah, yeah. They'll weigh in, you know, a little side chair, maybe 7 pounds or so. And as opposed to a factory-made Windsor that might be 13, 14, 15 pounds. Huge difference there if you're picking this thing up and moving and cleaning around it. But certainly 200 years ago, they're moving the chairs to sit in them. And I mean, you probably remember too, but I remember growing up and going to visit my grandmother up in the mountains, and after dinner, all the men would retire to the porch with the dining room chairs.
I noticed from sitting in these chairs, there's a little give to them when you sit down, and that's intentional, right?
That is intentional, and you don't find that in the factory-made chairs. Typically, they have to be made with thicker parts, but the way a good Windsor chair, a good handmade Windsor chair is made, and the way the 18th century ones were made, is the parts are split from the log. So I don't buy lumber, except for the seat. The seat's a sawn plank that I would use. But all the other parts are split straight from the log, green. And that way I can ensure perfectly straight wood fibers. When a saw at a sawmill saws a tree, it saws it kind of straight, but it does not know exactly how that tree grew. So you'll get run out, grain run out. And that weakens the piece. So the part, like the spindles in the back, would need to be made thicker in order to not break. And then they don't have a give to them. A handmade Windsor, it's split stock. Then it's shaped, a miner mostly shaped with a draw knife. But even if it's mounted on a lathe and turned, the wood fibers are pretty close to, can be pretty close to 100% straight. So the part can be much smaller, which makes the chair prettier, makes the chair lighter, but also makes the chair resilient to give with your body whenever you sit in it. The other thing that does too is what tears chairs apart is the constant shock of sitting in it and putting pressure on the joints, and finally the joints start giving. If the parts can flex, then they're absorbing some of that shock and not transferring it to the joint, but the part has to be small enough to flex, and in order to be small enough, it has to be perfectly straight grain, and in order to get that perfectly straight grain, it has to be split by hand out of a log.
You don't have to go very far here to source your wood.
No, not very far at all. There's a lot of sawmills around. Yeah, I'm using wood that's readily found just right around us. But of course, in the southern Appalachians, we're living in the most diverse temperate forest that's in the world. It's pretty phenomenal, and I wish we'd pay more attention to what we have around us. It's pretty incredible, and we should take care of it. But yeah, hickories, oaks, ash, maples. So Windsors were typically made, 18th century Windsors were typically made out of three, possibly even four different woods. And they're chosen for a function. They're not chosen for a beauty. They're chosen for its function. So nowadays, we're so far removed from wood that we only appreciate it for its beauty, which is just one of many things to appreciate about it. Whereas in the 18th century, they appreciated its function because they lived with it. So they knew that a spoon should be made out of a tight grain wood like maple, not a real open grain wood like red oak. They knew that a wagon wheel hub needed to be something that couldn't split like elm, and the spokes of the wagon wheel made out of something with high tensile strength like hickory. So this was probably kind of common understanding. I've gotten asked many times over the 42 years I've made chairs, will you make me one out of walnut? You know, because walnut is a beautiful wood. But walnut, it would be a far inferior chair if you made a Windsor completely out of walnut. It's just not strong enough for the spindles. Bending it is kind of iffy. In the turnings, for the turnings, especially my baluster turnings that have a lot of detail on it, you want a wood that is hard but also close grain, like hard maple. And you can get these crisp, clean, sharp edges in there. Whereas a wood that would be strong enough, like white oak, for instance, it's hard to hold those edges because it's a ring porous hardwood. So it has these open pores in the early wood that grows in the spring, and it just can't hold that edge, be strong enough, like I said. Walnut would have a difficulty. It's just not as strong as sugar maple. Yeah, so the wood is chosen specifically for a function, so it's appreciated. Most of the turnings of on my chairs, I would only use sugar maple. I would not even substitute red maple or cherry that is similar but just a little bit weaker and not quite as close grain.
Let's go back 42 plus years. Tell me what initially piqued your interest in making chairs and what kind of apprenticeship you might have served and how you learned this craft.
When I was about 30, you know, it was obvious to me that you keep this carpenter work up for the next 30 years, you're going to be beat up. It's tough, you know, it's tough. You're handling big sheets of plywood. There's dangerous places, dangerous situations that you get into where you can get injured quite often. And I happened to run across a book, Drew Langsner wrote it, called Country Workshops. And it was working wood, green, working wood out of the log with mainly using a draw knife and a shaving horse. A shaving horse would be this bench that you sit on and work with your foot and the jaws come down. It's very simple and old. And that was the end and the beginning. It was the end of everything that preceded that. And, you know, I had never been bit like that in my whole entire life. I just kind of slogged through life. I had a good time and I traveled a lot and all that.
Well, how hard is this? I mean, what kind of ability does it take? You know, how many years does it take to get proficient at it?
I'm still learning. Hard, there'd be two definitions of that. One would be physical, and it's physical. Splitting logs is physical. I like physical work. You know, my dad liked physical work. He liked to dig ditches. I'd rather dig a ditch than watch television. The other would be the skill. And I've taught a lot over the years, and I've seen, on rare occasion, I've seen somebody, I don't teach anymore, seen somebody come through that just really has a lot of talent and a lot of skill just built in. I wasn't one of those. I was stubborn and I wanted to do this. And I think anybody who just gets passionate about it can teach themselves. It took me longer than everybody else. But I got help right from the beginning, and this gets back to your other question, is I found out Windsor chairs were made like this, but there was nothing written on them. Now there's quite a bit of stuff written on it, and of course the whole internet's full of YouTube videos, people and everything. But at that time there was zero information out there. And I was trying to make a chair, and I just wasn't smart enough to do it. And just happened to run across a chair maker in Vermont that was staying the summer in North Carolina on a farm. And he's the one that gave me the key. He told me that, yes, I could make Windsor chairs. It's not that difficult. And that helped a lot, you know, because I had been told just the opposite by a lot of woodworkers. And then he gave me some drawings that he had. And we corresponded through the mail for a year. and I made about 15 chairs on my own, not very good ones, but I did make them. And then in would have been about June of 84, he invited me up to his shop in Vermont, no charge, just invited me up to. He told me my questions were getting too difficult to answer by letter now. And so I went up there, and I only spent a week with him, but I had made 15 chairs over a period of 6 or 7 months. So I was ripe for his instruction. And I couldn't drive home fast enough to get back to the shop to implement a lot of stuff that he showed me. And then, yeah, after that, it was just work in the shop and just try to get better. I'm still trying to get better. I'm still amazed at what I don't know.
The tools you have in this shop, how similar are they to tools that were used in the 18th century?
Some are the exact thing. Some are a modern version of it. As far as power tools go, I mean, the reason that I chose to do this was to get to work with the tools. So I've stayed with these simple hand tools. I love these tools. That's what I wanted. And I started out before Windsor's looking, trying to figure out what can I make with these tools. So I've only added a bandsaw that is just a cutoff saw for me. That's about all it does. And the lathe that I use has always had a motor on it. But the lathe is unique in itself. One, it's the only stationary power tool that goes back 4,000 or 5,000 years. It's the same tool. Something is turning a spindle, and you're using your hand to cut it. So in essence, it's a hand tool, even if electricity is powering it. But the power source has changed over the years from either water or a mule or a slave or an apprentice or a foot to the electricity.
Your passion for making Windsor chairs seems to be as strong as it ever was.
I'm just eat up with it 42 years later at 72 years old. I just can't wait to get down to the shop.
Curtis Buchanan, thank you for joining us for Vital Voices.
Well, thanks a lot, Fred. I enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Curtis Buchanan, who makes Windsor chairs in Jonesboro, Tennessee. For Vital Voices, I'm Fred Sossman.